This is not only starting May 8th, White Lotus Day, or whatever you want to say, maybe soon to start, but it is very close to the full moon of the month of Wesak. That will be the 11th. That will be Monday. And the full moon actually comes just about noontime. It would be a noontime on Eastern Standard Time, Daylight Time. And I want to come back to that a little bit because the full moon of Wesak was a very important time in the life of Buddha. Now, most of you realize that if you look at Christianity if you have any familiarity at all with Buddhism, you look at Buddhism, indeed if you look at Islam or any of a number of different religions, the life of the founder is just as important as the teachings of the founder. And it certainly is to the Buddhists. Buddhist iconography, sculptures, paintings, various statuary, constantly depict important events in the life of Buddha. Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Olcott both embraced Buddhism. Indeed, Colonel Olcott was so important in the revival of Buddhism in Sri Lanka, or what the British couldn't pronounce it, so they called it Ceylon, that his birthday is celebrated as a national holiday in Sri Lanka. He became a vegetarian. He traveled widely. He produced, being a sort of a pragmatic American, he produced a kind of a catechism that all Buddhists could agree on. He had to travel a long time and had to bend a little bit, bend some arms and twist some arms or whatever in order to get them all to agree. But it is still in print, and it is still paid attention to. It's a very remarkable person. Blavatsky had trouble being a vegetarian, and she was more interested in the writing of journal articles for the publication that she started, the Theosophist magazine. So she wasn't as actively involved in Buddhism, but both of them took panchil, took the five vows of Buddhism. So here you have a Russian noblewoman and an American who had been raised a Christian embracing the cause of the Orient, embracing the cause of Buddhism. And it is in dedication to them that I offer this talk, The Wonderful Life of Siddhartha Gautama the Buddha. Some of you have probably heard of that book about the life of Jesus, The Greatest Story Ever Told. This is the greatest story ever told. They got it wrong. So it'd be appropriate to start with the Buddhist daily prayer. And I'm not going to try to do the tonal chant because I don't know it. Namo tasso bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tasso bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tasso bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Tutyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. I bow in homage to the Blessed One, the Perfect One, the Fully Enlightened One. I go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And then the part that I didn't chant. I promise to abstain from injuring any sentient being, from speaking falsehood, from taking anything which does not belong to me, from incontinent behavior, and from imbibing any stupefying or intoxicating substance. All Buddhists repeat this, especially in the Theravada tradition, repeat this every day, often in front of a little statue. We have a picture of the Buddha, at least in a Chinese manifestation in the back. We often speak of the teachings of the Buddha at Theosophical lectures. We don't spend too much time talking about the life of Gautama, the Buddha. And so I want to do that tonight. I also want to preface it by saying that many of you might think of India as a land of large numbers of people. Well, yes, there are people there, but primarily it is the land of crows and stories. And I'm not sure which is more numerous, but I suspect the stories are. They have just an incredible story tradition. And the life that I'm going to talk about today is taken from a life that was written many centuries after Buddha lived. So one can't take it seriously as history, but that isn't the important thing. The Buddhists believe that it is history just as the Christians believe the gospel stories are history. I don't think the latter is true, but it makes no difference, because if they are a metaphor, the metaphor or the archetype or the symbolism of the story is more important than the history. As Plato pointed out, myth is what history is trying to live up to. So myth is living, and it is something that we are trying to embody in our lives, in history. There are various versions in the Buddhist literature. This is only one, and I can't possibly even talk about a small number of the stories. But basically, Buddha was born in a sort of a royal family. He was born in the Lichavi tribe, which wasn't a terribly powerful kingdom, but it was a fairly wealthy kingdom. In fact, if you do a study of ancient India, you realize there are some indications in some literature of the salaries, you'd say, of various different people. And we know that India was constantly a prey for invasions. And the reason for that is because it was wealthy. Not as it is today, poverty-stricken. That's why the British went there. That's why the Muslims went there. That's why the Greeks went there, going backwards in history, because there was wealth there. And even the peasant getting really relatively modest salary was fairly well off. And if you look at the amount of money that some of the royalty, some of the aristocracy had, it must have been enormous. So Buddha was born in some sort of luxurious surrounding. His father was the Raja or king of the Sakya or Shakya tribe. I'll use the Pali terminology because probably the language, the dialect that was spoken by the Buddha was a dialect called Magadha at that time. And I think that you might call it sloppy Sanskrit. Sanskrit was the aristocratic language, and the Buddha spoke in the language of the people. So the sha comes out as a sa, a dharma comes out as dhamma, and so forth and so forth. It's sort of sloppy Sanskrit. His father was Suddhodana, the king of the Sakyas. His mother's name was Maya. It's a very interesting name. In other words, the name really means illusion. There were miraculous elements in his conception and his birth. His mother had a dream of a white elephant when she became impregnated. And this was an indication that the child was going to be a very special child. Now you say, a white elephant. That means something that you can't get rid of, something bad. You know where we got that? Barnum. Barnum knew that a white elephant was sacred in India. They are extremely rare, albino elephants. So he had one brought over to his circus and it bombed. Nobody cared. So we have the reverse meaning here as in India, where it is a symbol of miraculousness or special nature. Now, during her pregnancy, she had various different signs that were given to her. And when she was about ready to give birth, she did what many Indian women to this day still do. She went to give birth in her native village. And, of course, she had to travel by foot. So she was walking this way, and unfortunately she went into labor at a little grove of trees, Lumbini Grove. And you see iconography of her hanging onto this tree with her foot against it, kicking the tree to do what? To waken the tree spirit. When we want luck, we knock on wood. You're not going to get luck knocking on a lectern. That doesn't work. You've got to knock on a tree. And you have to, not just any old tree, but some of the trees on the grounds here which have gods connected with them. Not all of them, I suspect, but surely a large number of them. So she was waking the tree god. And she gave birth standing up, and it was painless. This was on the full moon of May. In other words, the full moon of Vaisakh, which is sort of April, May, but mostly May. Trees flowered, and flowers rained down. The whole earth became still. The lion and the lamb lay down together, or something like that, a metaphor very similar to that. And so you have this marvelous metaphor of all nature being still, hushed, and reverent before this birth. The gods looked down from above, Now, there are a number of different stories about this. Robert in the Elder Hostel this morning mentioned one version of it. I've heard other versions. But in any event, the future Buddha, at his birth, at the moment of birth, is supposed to have stood up and taken several steps. One of them is in four directions and announced this was his last birth, pointing up to heavens. The other is three strides. It doesn't really make any difference, but he was an extraordinarily precocious youngster at birth. My son didn't walk until very much later than that, so he's just an ordinary person. Astrologers and physiognomists came to the palace to read the signs on his body, to cast his astrological chart and so forth. And they told his father, I won't go into all the details, they told his father that he was either going to become a great world teacher or a great world ruler. Well, his father was a king. Guess what he wanted? A doctor's son, they want him to be a doctor, and a professor's son, they want him to be an engineer. No, they want him to be a professor. You don't make him any money as a professor. But his father decided that he was going to do everything in his power to see that the child grew up to be a king. And, of course, he was raised in the palace. And the palace, even as I say, in this minor kingdom, was fairly luxurious. There's some lovely stories about how his father would bring servants in, lovely dancing girls and beautiful maidens and so forth. And when any one of them got sick, she just didn't show up that day. And as they got a little older, they were replaced by younger ones. So he was raised in this atmosphere of nothing but good. All beautiful, wonderful food, wonderful music, and so forth like this. There are also some interesting stories about his compassion as a young child. One day, he had a cousin named Devadatta, and this is an interesting name because it literally means gift of God, or gift of the gods, and Devadatta was anything but. His cousin was a very different sort of person and was out hunting a swan, or I think most Indologists feel that the word hamsa really means sort of goose, but swan sounds so much better. So he was out hunting a swan. He shot the swan, and it fell at Siddhartha's feet. The name Siddhartha, also the given name of the Gautama, the Buddha, is very interesting because it means he who achieves his end. Very appropriate name for him. His name was Siddhartha, given name. His family name was Gautama. So he is Siddhartha Gautama, as he was raised. He saw the swan fall at his feet with the arrow. He realized the bird was injured but not killed. So he took the arrow out and put healing herbs on it and tended it and took care of it. Well, meanwhile, Devadatta was looking around for his swan because he knew that he had shot it. And he finally found that Siddhartha had it and was nurturing it back to health. So he said, "Give me the swan. I shot it. It's mine." And Siddhartha said, "No, it's mine. I'm taking care of it." And they were wrangling back and forth till a holy man came along and said, "Life begins belongs to he who tries to save it." Well, you could see right away that Devadatta wasn't wildly enthused about this decision. And you see him appearing later on in the life of Siddhartha as a rival to him. And that metaphor of the swan shot with the arrow becomes very important in Buddhist teachings later on. At the age of 16, something like that, he was married to a woman named Yasodhara, who was Devadatta's sister. There again shows the relationship. And they had a son named Rahula. It's difficult to know. Different stories differ on this. One story has the son was born when Siddhartha was about 29, some a little earlier than that, some very much earlier than that, and it doesn't make that much difference. But one day he decided that since he was going to inherit the kingdom, he was going to follow his father on the throne, that he ought to at least see the kingdom that he was going to rule. Well, his father made sure that everybody who was sick or crippled or, you know, old or something like that, closet cases, stayed in the closet that day. Nothing but people that were healthy, happy, and so forth. And the village was filled with buntings and wonderful decorations and so forth, as the young prince rode forth in his chariot with his charioteer Channa driving the chariot. And he noticed the fields, the green rice paddies and so forth out there, and it looks so idyllic and so beautiful. And all of a sudden, he came upon one of these that got out of the closet. Somebody who was sick, he was shaking. And he asked Chandra, what's the matter with that guy that he shakes like that? Well, he's sick. Sick? Sick? What's that? Well, it's sort of the natural thing. You know, people get ill. And he didn't talk about germs, of course, but he gave him the idea. Then they went a little further. There are different versions of it. Sometimes that he went out separately for each one of the four signs, but in this case, I'll just tell them all in the same trip. And then he came upon somebody who was, as it were, walking on three legs, that is to say, with a cane. He's hobbling along. He got out of the closet, too. What's the matter with that guy? Well, he's old. He's old. You know, he's crippled. He's sort of supporting himself. Old? What? Old? What's that mean? Well, everybody grows old. You know, you're born, you grow up, you grow old. And this is very puzzling because he'd never seen anything like this. He hadn't heard about this before. Boy, talk about being sheltered. Then he went a little further, and there was a funeral procession that somehow got out. And he noticed that this man on this tray or whatever it wasn't moving. He said, what's the matter with him? Well, he's dead. Dead? Yes, everybody dies. They're born, they get ill, they grow old, and they die. This was greatly distressing to him. He had no idea that this was the nature of life. He'd been sheltered from all of this. So he got down from the chariot, and he sat under a tree where it was shady, and sort of meditated a little bit on this, wondered about this. Then he looked out into the fields, and he noticed something they hadn't noticed before. He noticed that the people plowing with their oxen were sweating, that it was hard work, that it wasn't quite so idyllic. And this all bothered him. All of these signs bothered him very much. Then he saw a man in yellow robes. Who is that? He said to Channa. That's a holy man. And he noticed the holy man's countenance was serene. And that left a deep impression on him. Well, he went back to the palace, and his father tried desperately to keep him locked in the palace. But on the full moon of Vaisakh, again, when he was 29, this is one of the versions. On other versions, they have different... some Buddhists like to have four holidays. So they have these on different times of the year. But the version I like is that they happen on Vaisakh. And remember, the full moon is going to come at a different time of Vaisakh. So it could have been different days of the month. But on the full moon of Vaisakh, when he was 29, he decided that he had to leave. It was the middle of the night. His beloved wife was sleeping next to him on the bed, and his dearly beloved son was next to them. And he realized that he couldn't wake them up because their entreaties would dissuade him from what he felt was his higher duty, to try to find an answer to the sufferings and miseries of life. So he felt that his duty to his family was important, but his duty to humanity was higher. He also knew that his wife and son would be well taken care of by their doting grandfather, his father. Right? So he did, it wasn't sort of abandoning them like people get somebody pregnant and then, you know, run off and leave the woman alone. It wasn't that sort of situation at all. But remember, his father had set up guards at the gates, and he'd locked the gates. Well, the gods put a deep sleep on the whole palace. And as he got out of his bed and started to go into the courtyard, the dancing girls were lying around in various postures with their saris blown off by the breeze, revealing themselves and sort of snoring and slobbering and so forth. And he realized that underneath this veneer of beauty, there was something that was not quite so beautiful. He came to the stable where he wakened his charioteer Channa, who saddled up the horses, and of course they had cobblestone courtyard. The gods muffled the horse beats. The guards at the gate fell into a deep trance, and the gates magically opened, and he rode out into the forests. When he got to the edge of the forest, this was by that time daybreak, he saw a beggar. He took his sword out of his sheath. I mean, he was royalty, after all. And he cut off his hair with the sword, gave his sword and the hair to Channa to indicate his renunciation. This was a kind of way of indicating renunciation, to either cut your hair or shave it off altogether, so that he would send it back and his father would know that he was serious at this. He exchanged his royal clothing with the beggar's costume and went out into the forest. Now, during this time, He met with Brahmins. He studied first with Alara Kalama. Alara Kalama presumably taught him something of the metaphysics of the Upanishads, though we're not absolutely certain. And after studying with him for a while, he had not attained enlightenment, so he left him and studied with Udaka Ramaputra, the son of Rama, Ramaputra. And again, he studied for a number of years and still hadn't attained enlightenment. What they taught him was metaphysical speculation. It's very important because later on he felt that metaphysical speculation was not the way to enlightenment. He then decided he would try something else. He would try the practice of extreme austerities, and he joined a band of naked ascetics. I mean, when they renounced everything. It's a little easier to be a naked ascetic in India than it is in the United States, especially in the northern climes. What Leadbeater sometimes, or one of our writers, sometimes called the so-called temperate climes. So he gave up everything, and very quickly, the six ascetics that he joined recognized him as their leader. He was, after all, a very regal and imposing figure. He was a remarkable-looking person. He did his meditations, his austerities, his fasting. He tries all kinds of penances. He did this for 6 years. And at the end of this time, he decided he still wasn't attaining enlightenment. He would really try some severe austerities. There are varieties of this in the literature. But the one I like is, on the first day of the month, he took 30 grains of rice. On the second, 29. On the next, 28. And he kept diminishing his supply of rice. One day, when he was so emaciated that when he... And this is in the Buddhist scriptures. When he went to clutch his stomach, he put his hands around his spine. I mean, that is skinny. And when you looked in his eyes, it was like looking into two deep wells. The eyes were so deep in the sockets. His bones were sticking out all over. He was emaciated. He was sitting underneath a tree. And a little girl, Sujata, who had prayed to the tree god for the birth of a child and had been granted this, came back every year to renew the thanks. And she always brought a little bowl of what they call in India curd. We would call it yogurt. And to her surprise, there was the tree god, a little emaciated, but clearly a remarkable figure sitting underneath the tree. So she offered it to him, and he decided to take this as an indication that he should break his fast. Well, the six ascetics kicked him out as a backslider. Incidentally, you will see iconography of him in his emaciated condition, and they really lay it on. It is quite remarkable. So he decided to wander around and on his own and see if he could find enlightenment. The Buddha stories aren't real clear about all of the things he did during this time. There must have been some things that led him ultimately to a town named Gaya. It's in Bihar state, present-day Bihar state, around the center of it. And he found a peepal tree, not P-E-O-P-L-E, P-I-P-A-L. And he sat underneath this. It's sometimes thought of as a banyan tree, but I've seen it in the literature mostly as a peepal tree, a fig tree of some sort, I believe. He sat under this and he vowed that he would not leave until he attained enlightenment, until he understood the meaning of life and how all of these things fit together. What was the purpose? Why are we here and where are we going? As Theosophists often put it, that motivates us to join a group like this. And there's a lovely story about this. He started in the evening, and through the watches of the night, notice the military metaphor, because after all, he was of the Kshatriya, or warrior caste. He wasn't a Brahmin. He was of the warrior caste. And through the watches of the night, various things happen. And clearly, the chief god, the Satan of Buddhism, Mara, couldn't let him attain enlightenment. So first he sent some sinuous dancing girls, you know, so, to try to distract him. And he recognized immediately that this was just a figment of his mind, and he brushed them aside. I mean, metaphorically, he didn't move. He was sitting in meditation under the tree. Then Mara tried some horrible sights, some ghastly demons with blood dripping down and fangs and all of this. And he recognized that that was nothing. He dismissed them. Notice that what you can see, this is a metaphor for the hidden stuff that's in our consciousness that must be dredged up and dealt with. Desire, fear, things like that. Finally, Mara sent his wife and his son, pleading for him to come back. We're so lonely, you've abandoned us. He recognized that also as a delusion, brushed it aside, and finally Mara himself came. And he said, "You have no teacher. You can't attain enlightenment." Because it was a tradition that the only way you could attain enlightenment was to get it from somebody who had enlightenment. And the Buddha pointed to the ground and said, "The earth is my teacher." There was an earthquake or a rumbling. Mara disappeared, and the dawn broke. It was the last watch of the night. The dawn broke, and he attained enlightenment. Notice the metaphors in this. Really, I hardly say it without breaking up. The metaphors in this story, very interesting. And he realized the nature of the universe, the nature of our place in it, which was the basis of his teaching. He also realized that it was so profound that he didn't know who he was going to teach. And some say that he had to meditate for a while before he decided he had to teach. But the whole goal of it was his teaching, so I don't particularly like those stories, so I'll leave them out. Do my own version of the Buddha Charita, or the career of Buddha. And he put in his mind, "I shall teach," I've got to go back and look at my notes again, "I will teach Alara Kalama. He was a good man. He tried to enlighten me." And immediately the thought came back, he died a fortnight ago. Notice the paranormal events, that when you attain this, you gain a paranormal knowledge about the world. And this runs all through Buddhism, although it is not made a big thing of. Then he said, "Well, let me teach that Udalaka Ramaputra. He too was a good man, tried to enlighten me." And the thought immediately came back to him, "He died last night." Then he said, "Well, let me teach those six ascetics. They too are my companions. They were good people." And the thought came back immediately, "They are at the deer park at Sarnath," which is sort of across the stream from modern-day Varanasi, or again, the British couldn't pronounce that, so they called it Banaras. And so he started off on his journey to this. Now, this is a long way away. And remember, he's going by foot, so it took him 2 months to get there. So on the way, he met a man who said, I don't remember his name, who said, "Sir, your face shines like one who has attained knowledge. Teach me." And the Buddha tried. And the man said something like, "Siadvada," or "That may be the case." Siad is the optative form of the verb to be. It simply means maybe. He said, "For all of me, it may be, but I don't understand you." So his first sermon was a failure. He kept on going until he got to the deer park. And the monk said, "Oh, there's that backslider Siddhartha. Don't have anything to do with him." But as he got closer, one of them relented and he walked out to them, and pretty soon the others followed. And so he started the teaching there. This is on the full moon of Asala, which is sort of late June or July. It's a July month. Again, notice the full moon. Notice the metaphor of the moon. Now, what is the moon when it's full? The moon is related to us, isn't it? It has effects upon our body, has effects on the oceans and so forth. So it is something that is close to the physical. It sometimes is thought of as the psychic nature. But when it's full, it fully reflects the sun. So it is the metaphor of the sun fully reflected in our lower nature. Interesting kinds of metaphors in this. So he taught them, and this is called Dhammachakra Pravartana, the turning of the wheel of the law, Dhamma, of the teaching. And they were his first disciples. They all joined his Sangha. So this is the beginning of his Sangha, his order, these first ascetics. His basic ideas were that life is inherently dukkha. Now, dukkha is usually translated suffering or sorrow, and you know darn well life isn't inherently suffering or sorrow. There are lots of pleasant moments in it. The word dukkha in Sanskrit, duh is a prefix like the Latin mal or the Greek dis. It means bad, something bad, as in dystrophy or maladroit or something like that. But what does ka mean? Well, linguists aren't really sure, but they think it may be derived from the Sanskrit root sta, which means to stand. So that would mean to stand uneasily, stand poorly. In other words, what? Insecurity. And that I can relate to. That, I'd say, is pretty close to what we all have in some form or other. So life is inherently one of insecurity, not so much suffering, although it's often translated that. All life is inherently dukkha. The cause of dukkha is desire, thirst, craving for sensate things, and the fear of losing them. Dukkha can be overcome by eliminating its cause, and the means to do this is the Noble Eightfold Path. There are your Four Noble Truths. Dukkha, the cause of dukkha, the elimination of dukkha, and the way to eliminate it, the Four Noble Truths. The Noble Eightfold Path is the means. Right views, samyak drishti. Drishti means seeing. So it's right insight, it's right seeing. And it could mean something like faith in the teaching of Buddha, but it means really deeply understanding things for oneself, not believing out of blind faith. It implies direct realization of the main tenets of Buddhism. Then the next is right resolve or right intention, samyak samkalpa. I'm using the Sanskrit version of these, with which I'm a little bit more familiar than the Pali. Samkalpa is effort, resolve, trying to do something, applying oneself to the teachings, not being a hypocrite, you know, going to church on Sunday and doing other things the rest of the week. It also means resolving not to injure any living being, to be at peace with the world. The third is right speech, vak or vacha. And this means abstaining from lying, slander, verbal abuse, and, C.W. Leadbeater, one of our writers, loved this, idle conversation. He also converted to Buddhism. You know, there was a time at the national headquarters, Olcott, that people weren't allowed to talk during mealtimes. They all had to be very quiet and very meditative. That's the influence of C.W. Leadbeater, and you can blame Buddha for that. It means especially not gossiping. Now, that's one, I think, that we can relate to a little bit more clearly. We do like to tell stories about other people, don't we? And sometimes by putting them down, it seems to put us up. But that's really bad. It's vicious. One should never speak out of anger or a motive for revenge, he said. All of this is involved in right speech. The fourth is samyak karmanta. Anta is end, karma, action. So the end of action, right conduct. And it involves strict ahimsa, not taking the life of any sentient being. Although killing a mosquito is considered less serious than killing a higher animal, including a human being. They weren't as ahimsa as the Jains, who won't kill anything at all. And right action also involves abstention from sexual misconduct or taking something that doesn't belong to you. How often when you walk along might you find a penny or a dime or, if you're really lucky, a $5 bill just lying by the side of the road? The Buddhist would walk past because it doesn't belong to him. We stop and pick it up. Right? So we don't follow that of the Noble Eightfold Path. But strictly speaking, not taking anything that doesn't belong to you. The next is samyak ajiva. A is a prefix meaning to or toward. Jiva is life, so it's livelihood. It means avoiding any occupation which would give harm to living beings, and that means not cheating other human beings. Obviously, you can't be a warrior, although not all Buddhists live up to all of these ideals. They do have armies in some Buddhist countries. It means not hunting, not selling weapons. Indirectly, it means not engaging in usury, cheating, selling defective goods, and the Buddha included fortune-telling. Ooh, all you astrologers in the crowd, watch out. The last three were meant mainly for the monastics. And these are ideals. You're supposed to live up to them to the best of your ability. Nobody assumes that you're going to live up to them perfectly. The last three were right effort, samyak vyayama, right mindfulness, samyak sati, and right concentration or meditation, samyak samadhi. Right effort is defined in Buddhist scripture as the endeavor to ward off unwholesome mental phenomena, violent, lascivious, critical judgments, merely wandering thoughts, to produce in one's mind wholesome ones, compassion, serenity, detachment. Right mindfulness or awareness gives us the Buddhist form of meditation, vipassana, or sometimes called satipatthana, awakened awareness. It's an attitude of attention to exactly what is happening within one's sensory field or in the mind without adding or overlooking anything. This is basically what Jiddu Krishnamurti was recommending. So near the end of his life, when they asked him, well, basically, aren't you just teaching Buddhism? He said, in fact, yes. A lot of his stuff relates to the same approach to life, although he put it in modern and sometimes psychological forms. Right samadhi is a profound meditative state, often translated trance, though it is utterly unlike the mediumistic or hypnotic trance. It is said to transcend our ordinary sensorial or empirical consciousness, as well as to transcend the mind. To contemplate the essential no-thingness of all phenomena in a blissful state of at-one-ment with all. In it one gains the siddhis, the psychic faculties, telepathy, clairvoyance, including the remembrance of all one's past births or past lives. Now, I think that it's I might at this point point out that one of the basic teachings of Buddhism is what is called anicca or anitya, non-permanence of things. Everything is ceaselessly in change. There is not one moment that is the same as the next. Indeed, you couldn't have two moments if they were the same, could you? There has to be some difference in order for them to be a new moment. And they took this radically. Everything, from the top of the universe down to the bottom, everything is dynamic, ceaselessly changing. Now, one of the interesting things about some of the schools, especially coming out of the Upanishads in India, is that they feel that Atman is an unchanging reality, and that we are deluded because we think we are living in this sensate, limited, finite world, when in fact we are unlimited Atman. So what happens when you attain realization of yourself, self-realization? Well, you don't really attain anything, because everything else is only appearance. So we apparently work apparently for an apparent realization, which we apparently attain, but nothing really happens, because reality is defined as changeless, independent. And the Buddha said, there is no such thing. So when I look in the Secret Doctrine, the magnum opus of Madame Blavatsky, and I see her saying that Advaita and Buddhas and esoteric Buddhism are essentially saying the same thing, I have problems as a philosopher. I mean, to me, they're radically different. Now, there may be some way of reconciling these. Maybe when you attain that enlightenment, I haven't come even close yet. When you attain that enlightenment, maybe you will say, ha, they were both right. It's just different ways of looking at it. I find it difficult to believe that. They're so radically different. And I like to believe the Buddhist, because this means that we're not stuck where we are. We are processes. And once we recognize the process, the mind is not a thing. It's not a bag in which thoughts occur. It is the thinking process itself. And when you observe that, when you see that, you watch the process of the mind, somehow it robs the mind of its tendency to be attracted to things. So this is vipassana meditation, simply looking at this, watching the mind and trying to recognize how you think and overcome it. And you can see that lots of the different schools of Buddhism, as they spread to China and Japan, really kept this essential idea. Zen meditation is very much in the same style. It looks utterly different from Buddhism, but that's the essence of Buddhism, is this kind of meditation. Now, Buddha had some troubles with actually showing these psychic faculties that one is supposed to attain. And there's some lovely stories about this. I'll just mention one. There was a merchant who had set up a beautifully carved sandalwood begging bowl on the top of a tall bamboo pole, tied it up there. And it was to go to any of the Brahmanas or Shramanas. Indians love these rhyme words. Brahmins, high caste, or Shramans, meaning heretics like Buddhists and other naked ascetics and you know, people like this. Anyone who could levitate up, untie it, and pluck it off. Well, apparently a number of the Brahmins tried, and they didn't get off the ground. I mean, literally didn't get off the ground. And one of the monks, one of the advanced disciples of Buddha, came upon this and saw this. It was just child's play for him. He not only levitated up, untied, and took off the bowl, he circled the village three times before he came down. And there was a great huzzas and shouting and hoorays and so forth. Well, the Buddha was off in a grove outside of the village. He never went into the village. He always stayed in a grove outside the village. And he wondered what all of this noise was. Well, one of the monks came back and said, it's the monk Pindola who's fetched down the householder's bowl. He says, call him to me. So Pindola came in. Pindola Bharadvaja, as I recall, was his name. He came in and the Buddha said, smash the bowl, grind it up, and use it for unguent. In other words, it was the underarm deodorant of that day, right guard, or whatever you want to say, the ancient India right guard. And he chastised. He didn't say, oh, come on, you didn't really do it. He chastised him for demonstrating these powers. Why? Why wouldn't you say, well, my heavens, this would get all kinds of disciples. You'd attract a huge crowd. They'd follow after you. Because then they will be attracted to the psychic, and then they have desire for that. And they aren't going to pay any attention to the teaching. There's also a lovely story about the Buddha one time walking with disciples alongside of a river. And there was this holy man sitting next to the river, you know, serious as Shramana of a different order. And the disciples said, don't have anything to do with that man, you know, that old coot, you know. The Buddha went over to him and said, sir, how long have you been meditating here? 20 years! And what have you managed to accomplish in that? I can walk across the water on the surface. He said, what a shame to waste 20 years when there's a little boy that will ferry you across for a penny. So he was very much opposed to the showing of these psychic powers. His was a middle way between the extremes of self-indulgence, which he had known in his youth, which is, in the words of the Buddhist scriptures, low, vulgar, worldly, unspiritual, and useless, and asceticism, which he had also experienced very dramatically, which he says is, quote, painful, unspiritual, and useless. So it's a middle way between these. You take enough to keep your body going, but not more than you need. And you don't certainly get involved in luxuries. But it's also a middle way between what we would call blind faith and metaphysical speculation. He felt that metaphysical speculation was also useless. There's a wonderful story about a monk who joined the order, and finally, meditating one day, he came to think, you know, the Blessed One hasn't taught me whether the universe is finite or infinite, whether the soul exists after death or doesn't exist after death. He had a whole series of these. And it's real nice for studying Pali because it keeps repeating the same thing. So after you've got the first, about 10 lines of it, you know all the vocabulary for the rest of this. You only have to look up one or two words. Keeps repeating itself. Very boring to read. But then he went to the Buddha and he put all of these questions. And the Buddha said, did I ever guarantee to teach you these things? Well, no. If I told you that the universe was endless or was not endless, that we survive after death or not survive after death, we could go endlessly into this speculation and never get anywhere. And then he used the image of a man shot with an arrow. Notice the swan story coming back. He said, suppose you came upon a person shot with an arrow, and before you took that arrow out and healed him, you wanted to know what the arrow was made of, what bird the feathers came from, what was the cast of the archer, what was the string of his bow made of, what kind of wood was the bow made of, and so forth. He says, that man would die before you did all.
He only guaranteed to give you the cause of your insecurities in life and the cure of them. That's all. And metaphysical speculation got you nowhere. And that, of course, he had learned early on in his search. I won't go into some of the other teachings because it isn't important here. But I want to share a few other of the stories, especially one of the stories that Madame Blavatsky wanted told at her commemoration, this story of Kisa Gotami. Kisa means frail, so she was frail Gotami. She was a little girl who had a son. She was apparently very young. Indians married quite young. It was not at all unusual to marry at 12 or 13. And she had a son who, according to one version of the story, was playing with a snake one day, and then pretty soon he grew cold, and the snake didn't. The snake slithered away, but the boy grew stiff and cold. And she was distraught. And somebody says, well, look, there's this holy man over there, and holy men are supposed to be sort of omnicompetent. So go to the holy man and ask him. So she brought her son to the Buddha, and he said, yes, I know some medicine that could cure him and you at the same time. Go into the village and get a tola. A tola is a small amount of mustard seed, black. But you must take it from a house where no one has ever died. Well, she went around and she begged from one house to another throughout the village. And they said, oh, sure, we'll give you the mustard seed, but unfortunately our servant died. Oh, we'll give you the mustard seed, but sure, my grandfather died and so forth. She couldn't find a single one in which there hadn't been someone who died. She came back the next day with her son, who was already dead, had been dead the day before. And she realized what the Buddha was trying to teach her. That death is just part of the human cycle. And so she was cured and ultimately joined the order. Incidentally, as he was traveling around, he also went back to his homeland and he converted his father. His father never became a monk. I mean, he did have sort of kingly duties. But he became a layman. But his wife, Yasodhara, became a nun. And his son, Rahula, became a monk. And indeed, Rahula is a very common name for a boy, in a monastic name especially, in Sri Lanka. There's a very famous scholar named Walpola Rahula, whom I heard give a talk on Buddhism. So that this idea carries on. So he formed an order, and as the order was growing, he had to kind of make some rules. And they were very ad hoc at the time. They kind of grew as situations came up. But one of the things that happened as women started coming into the order was he's going to have to make some way of keeping the monks' minds off of sex. Because that's, you know, that's desire. So the monks were not supposed to look at a woman. And one of the monks then asked him, well, suppose in the begging round, they keep their eyes down. Suppose we have to look at a woman. Well, if you have to look upon her, if she's younger, as your child, if she's older, as your mother, if she's the same age as your sister. See, that leaves one very important relationship out. Well, there's a wonderful story. I don't know if it's in the Buddhist scriptures, but I love it anyway. I'm just going to pretend it's in the Buddhist scriptures. Of two monks, an older one and a younger one, who the Buddha didn't want the monks to have any permanent home. During the rainy season, it becomes very difficult to get around in India. It gets muddy, it's sloppy, and so forth like this. So rest homes, viharas, were set up in various places by wealthy householders to get the monks to stay there. And this was after the rainy season, and these two monks were walking on their journeys. They came to a stream that, of course, after the rainy season was in spate, was full of water, and it was rushing down. And there was this beautiful little girl standing beside. She was afraid to cross for fear that she would be swept off her feet and drowned. And the elder monk said, "Here, climb up on my back. I'll carry you across." Carried her across, set her down. This was early in the morning. She went her way. They two monks went on their way. And they went silently, and about evening, the young monk could not contain himself any longer. And he said, "Venerable sir, do you think it was right for you to carry that woman across the river?" And the older monk, who had long since forgotten this, broken from his reverie, said, "Son, I just carried her across the river. You've been carrying her all day." Again, you see the middle path. You see common sense in this. Devadatta was also one of the people who was converted to Buddhism. And Devadatta was absolutely convinced he was just as bright as the Buddha. And he didn't see any reason why the Buddha should be in charge of this order. He should. And he tried a number of different times to kill the Buddha. Ultimately, he broke off and formed his own order. We have historical evidence that this actually happened. It didn't last very long. Apparently, he got a number of disaffected monks to follow him, and gradually it just sort of dissipated. But one day, he decided to get Buddha trampled to death by getting a mad elephant. Buddha was in a path that had a lane of trees down it. And he's walking down one way. The elephant is charging at him down the other way. And the Buddha simply holds up his hand. And the elephant kneels at his feet. You find this in Buddhist iconography. It's a wonderful story. This tells you something about the power of this person. And there's a lovely book that we find in our literature called Footprints of Gautama the Buddha, which is said by a monk named Yasa, who was converted early on and rarely was able to travel with the Buddha. But it is based upon the Buddhist scriptures by Marie Biles. It is a wonderful book. It's an easily accessed story form of Buddha. And one of the things that Yasa said as he was sort of going to a village that the Buddha had been in before, "Everywhere I go, I see the footprints of the really great elephant." That was the Buddha. He made such an incredible impression upon people. Now, although I'm rapidly running, no, I have not rapidly running out of time, I've run out of time. I want to tell a story about one of these conversions. In a city named Savati, there was a king there who was patronized Buddhism. And the Buddha went there, and he was very surprised to see armed guards all around the place. And he asked the king, he says, "What's the matter? Are you in danger of being attacked by the neighboring kings?" "Oh, no, we're at peace with all of them. No problem. Why all the armed guards?" "Well, there's this robber named Angulimala who's in the neighborhood, and he's announced that he's going to attack us tomorrow." You know what Angulimala means? This is an anguli. Mala is a garland. When he robbed people, he cut off their fingers and strung them on a garland, and he wore it around his neck. And he struck terror in the hearts of people. And Angulimala was so sure that when he walked into the village, the soldiers would all fly away, that he was looking forward to having the king's fingers added to his garland. So the Buddha decided that this man, Angulimala, was in need of his teaching. So he went out to the cave where Angulimala was staying. And according to this version, Yasa is saying, "What happened when the master walked towards the robber den later, I heard from Angulimala himself." So here he's retelling the story. Angulimala was in the cave saying, "Adventure! Adventure! Kings conquer realms, I conquer kings. Tomorrow I raid Savati." He happened to glance to the right and saw the master passing by. It was a strange sight, a lonely yellow-robed monk walking right past his den. He drew his sword and shouted, "Stop, monk!" Master looked up and answered quietly, "I have stopped. It is you who have not," and continued walking. This puzzled Angulimala a little bit. So he drew his sword out and approached the man, the Buddha, and when he got in front of him, he dropped his sword and stared at this incredible monk. And then they sat down. And Angulimala asked, "Why have you come here?" And the Buddha said, "You have need of me, O chief." "I need of you?" "Yes." Angulimala tried to break the spell he felt was being woven around him, laughed as he went on, "Need of your fingers only, I think, since treasures you have none." So the master held out his hand and said, "My fingers you may have willingly, but you have need of more than those from me." "Oh, how so?" The master now spoke seriously. "You seek a greater adventure than you have yet conceived, a greater conquest than you have yet won. I have come to show you the way." Well, it goes on, and basically is the conquest of self. That's the greatest conquest of all. And so he leads Angulimala back to the brotherhood. And they see him coming. The king is there. And the king is trembling. Here's this. And by this time, he's in a yellow robe. Angulimala has joined the brotherhood. He's been initiated. And they say, wait a minute. But as soon as the Buddha says he is part of the brotherhood, immediately they accept him as one of their own. Then the Buddha offers him his adventure, his greatest challenge. Go into the village you have robbed on your begging round. Because you must pay the karmic debt that you have earned by robbing them and killing them and cutting off their fingers. He says, it's not going to be easy. Are you up to it? And Angulimala said, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of anything. And so at the end, you see him come back. One eye is put out. He's gashes in his head. He's bleeding. And he's smiling, saying, see, I'm not a coward. And he, very shortly after, according to this, attained enlightenment. This was the impact of this man's life. So when somebody says that Jesus' story is the greatest story ever told, I say, read the Buddhist scriptures. There is some absolutely remarkable stuff in this. And so I say, I think, this is just a touch, just a taste of a little bit. Such is the wonderful life of he whom the masters of the wisdom who founded the Theosophical Society called the greatest man who ever lived. Thank you.